Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota on Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.
Hello and welcome to Real Living. This is Lavinia Spirito with Mary Lou Nemechek, and we have a treat for you. We're going to switch up a little bit the subject of our shows, and I thought today we would talk about a very interesting article that's been in the press about an altar that was found, an original Crusader altar that was found in Jerusalem's Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Now, I thought we would go back and perhaps give us a little bit of background and history about the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, because not that many people know about it. I mean, they know that there's a church there, and they know that that's where the tomb of Jesus is, but they don't know, why the basilica looks so new. Why? So I went on the site of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So it's their official site of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And it gives the origins of the church that has been there since the time of Constantine. And we know, everybody knows Helen went to the Holy Land in her later years with a view of identifying the holy places, the places where Jesus had died and had sustained his passion, where he was born. There's some colorful stories about how she found the pit with the burial of the three crosses and how they went about determining which was the cross of Christ through its miraculous healing powers. But today, I think it's just good to kind of ground ourselves in history and in what the historical record has to say, because we don't have to make up stories, Our faith is a faith that is based on reason. It's based on historical facts. Now, the very early history and appearance of the church remain uncertain, obviously, because nobody took pictures of what may have lived there before. What we need to remember also is that in 6970 and then again in 125 AD, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem completely, well, pretty much completely, leaving a few structures standing, and built over certain sites temples. So, for instance, if memory serves correctly, the Roman emperor built over what had been venerated as the place of the crucifixion and burial of Jesus a temple. And I think it was a temple to Zeus. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was interesting, because what he actually did was far from removing the focus of the early Christians' devotion, is he preserved. The net effect of what he did was to preserve the site for Constantine. So perhaps, who knows what would have happened to the site if they hadn't thoughtfully erected a structure right on top of it, which had two functions. One, it marked the exact place that of the passion and the death, and two, it preserved the site. So I'm not sure that's the effect that the Roman conquerors had when they erected that particular temple, but there you have it. And so you have basically the site of the passion and of the crucifixion as a very early focus of Christian pilgrims, of Christian people who were devoted, Christian adherents. But what is also to be said is that obviously Christ died, he was buried, he rose, and then basically Jerusalem fell into the hands of people who did not want, who wanted to basically suppress Christian worship. And for a long time, it was hard for people to get to Jerusalem. We have some fascinating fascinating accounts in the fourth century of the Bishop of Jerusalem, Cyril, giving catechetical lectures to catechumens, but that is after Constantine. So, and we have, of course, fascinating accounts of a certain widow who went, Egeria, who went, Spanish widow, I think, who went to Jerusalem, who had the means to travel by herself as a woman, and to get to Jerusalem and to actually kind of sit around and behold what was going on in Jerusalem in the fourth century. But in the first century and in the second century, those sites were, they were venerated, but they were marked by a pagan temple. So fast forward 200 years, and lo and behold, we have Constantine becoming an emperor, and not becoming a Christian emperor, because remember, he doesn't get baptized until his deathbed, but his mother is most definitely a Christian. And he, you know, with his Edict of Toleration, the Edict of Milan in 312 or 313, he basically gave the Catholic Church a lease on life, a new lease on life, where they could emerge from the brutal persecutions that they had been sustaining with the uncertainties of life, etc. And actually, churches were being built. Now, we do know that some churches were built even during the time of persecution. I think the first Christian church that we have a record of was built around to the year 250, which would still be in the middle of the waves, you know, the times of the waves of the persecution. In this case, we have Constantine's mother coming to the Holy Land, identifying the holy places, and Constantine, of course, doing what he did best, which was build a beautiful basilica, a beautiful church. So after the rediscovery of the holy places, Constantine in 326 immediately decided to build a church. Now, if you know anything about the St. Peter's in Rome, you'll know that that too is the site of a Constantinian basilica, you know, that was the site of a Constantinian basilica.
The original one.
The original one, built in the fourth century, of course, and which was demolished and rebuilt in the present form in the 15 and the 1600s. So what they did is they went, now you and I have been there. You remember it's a rocky outcrop, right? It's a rocky right. place. It's kind of the Mount Calvary is higher up. You go up some set of stairs to behold Mount Calvary, and then you come down the stairs and go a little bit lower, and then you see the tomb of Christ. So it kind of reflects the geography, the existing geography of the time, because we're told that Jesus was led out the city, outside the city walls,
city gates,
and he was crucified on Mount Calvary, on a place called Golgotha, or the place of the skull. We know that for purification reasons, no place of death or no place of burial could be within the city walls, right? So at the time, of course, all this was outside the city walls. Of course, you know, with the passage of centuries, now it's firmly within, of course, the city walls. So interesting how both Mount Calvary, so the place of the crucifixion, and the tomb were isolated by cutting away the surrounding rock and earth, making them freestanding blocks. That's what Constantine did right at the beginning. And then right at the beginning, he put that rotunda, he put like a structure around the tomb, which is what you behold today, not obviously the original Constantinian structure, but you go and it's like this little midget church inside a church, right? It's a little tiny church inside a church. And so it's like this, it's called an edicola, which is just means a little building. And that's what it is. If you go today, you see the little building that encompasses just the two rooms of the tomb. So it's quite small.
With the small opening that you have to kind of bend down to get in.
To get in and do your two steps, etc., which reflects really the Jewish tombs of the first century, which would have been about, well, it says 9 feet. From what I remember from past research, it was around 9 feet long and about 4 or 5 feet, six feet wide. In it, it was two chambers. One was a chamber with benches where you would prepare the body. And then the next, you take a step down, and there would be the tomb itself, right? And right. that is, in fact, if you will remember, the way the tomb is constructed. It's a two-chamber tomb. So that's, I think that's really cute. And so we have Constantine building this church, surrounding the tomb with this original little building, and Calvary forming the southeast corner and the prison the northeast corner. So to the east of the courtyard itself was a large five-aisled basilica facing west and enclosing the crypt of St. Helena. And if you remember, today's basilica, today's church, if you go, you take some steps down and you go to the crypt of St. Helena. So it's all still there, except that obviously it's a newer rendition.
Right.
Interestingly, it's built along the lines of an imperial tomb, which would make sense because he was the Roman emperor. So there was the building enclosing the tomb, which is how they apparently buried royal and imperial families. Was they enclosed? They had you go to the necropolis, as you go to the, if you could see remains of ancient Roman funeral monuments for royals and emperors, there'll be these little buildings that are built around. I think it's where we get our mausoleum idea, right?
Right. But, you know, so, they used to go and visit the dead, and they used to take food and eat there and visit with them, and it was a family event. So it makes sense that they would have them enclosed in a structure so that you could go in there and share a meal or visit or however they were going to visit that relative.
So they're the original three elements that we're talking about, the little building around the tomb, the combination of a courtyard and the church, just created it was like a compound, basically. Mm-hmm. And there was a colonnade, which is some stairs, two-story circular colonnade, forming around the sepulchre. Now, the roof, it was covered by the end of the 4th century. Now, again, I'm reading off of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.net. Now, much of the Constantinian masonry of the outer wall survives. Like a lot of what you see when you go into buildings that have been restored since the period, they try to maintain the Constantinian walls and structures within the renovated walls so that you can see what they look like. The Rock of Calvary projected southeast corner and was surmounted by a great cross, and then a small chapel, the Church of Golgotha. So interestingly, it was a separate church. The Church of Golgotha was situated south of the rock, and the main church was Constantine's great basilica, which originally it was known as the Martyrium, which I thought was kind of cool. The place of martyrdom, right? So, right. Interesting. The total length of the basilica and the atrium was about 75 meters, which is, I think, about 150 feet, maybe, perhaps. It's three times, isn't it? No, it's 2.2. What is a meter? It's a 1.6. So, yes, it'd be around 120 feet, etc. It had double aisles surmounted by galleries, thus resembling really the original St. Peter's in Rome. So he knew how to build one kind of church, and that's what he did. He did it in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and he did it, of course, at St. Peter's in Rome. Unfortunately, none of these structures survive. We have the inner structures that are kind of propped up by the renovated walls. Now, the roof was of wood because, again, you know, that was the period. But according to Eusebius of Caesarea, who was a 4th and 5th century historian, it was magnificently decorated, sheathed in marble with a coffered ceiling painted in gold. So think about the early churches you may have seen in Rome, for instance, that have that similar idea of the coffered ceiling painted in gold. So the result, the original Constantinian basilica was a very splendid group of buildings. It was like a compound. Today, instead, the whole church roofs over what used to be separate buildings. The early pilgrim would have approached a triple gateway and entered. So they'd maintained that triple gateway, remember, in the geography of the basilica, mm-hmm. and entered the atrium of the basilica in a large colonnaded courtyard with lots of columns, and behind this would have been the basilica itself. The door at the end of the basilica laid into a second court containing the rock and the cross of Calvary. So that's just kind of telling you a little bit about what the original structure looked like. In 614, this original structure was destroyed by the Persians. So the famous Persian invasion. Remember when we went to the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, There were frescoes of the Magi visiting Christ, and they were dressed like Persians. And yes. So when in 614 these Persians came and destroyed the Church of the Holy Sepulcher, they did not destroy the Church of the Nativity because they recognized their own people in that church, which, again, I thought that was kind of cool. So the Christian shrines continued until about the year 1000, when one of the, now remember that the Arab conquest of the Holy Land occurred in 630, 638, but the buildings managed to survive until 1009, when one of the caliphs ordered the systematic destruction of the Holy Sepulchre and all the holy shrines. The basilica was entirely demolished. Calvary and the sepulcher were mutilated, but somewhat they were left a little bit, you know, in place. So the church was destroyed, but the structures inside survived up to a certain point, right?
Right.
Now remember, keep your dates straight. So in the year 1009, the Muslims start going to town and destroying the holy places. In about a century later, what happens? The First Crusade is called for the express purpose of rescuing the holy sites. So there is a connection, which I think should be, it's not like they decided to have this crusade because everything was hunky-dory and they just wanted to go invade foreign lands. It was because they were being asked to come and rescue the holy sites from the destruction that was occurring. So then you have long periods of which times you had some reconstruction, where you had restoration, etc. But the complete disappearance of the basilica meant that the whole site was now oriented to where it needed to be. The courtyard must have somehow resembled a cloister. Now, after 1099, when the Crusaders conquered Jerusalem in 1099 as a direct response to the invitation to come and save the holy places, remember one of the descriptions of the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre and of, for instance, the Knights of the Templar Knights, the Knights are called Templars because they consider themselves the Knights of the Temple of Jerusalem because they are there to preserve the holy places and to help the pilgrims. All right? So. Right. When the Crusaders finally conquered Jerusalem briefly in 1099, their immediate concern was to restore and beautify this holy sepulcher even further, which is why the existing structure is mostly Crusader, right? Crusader architecture. And it was consecrated on July 15th of 1149. Now, the Crusader plan is basically conserved in what we see today, right? We have... maybe some details that are different, but the sepulchre itself was enclosed in the little building, not the same building as Constantine, but another edicule constructed of marble and carved. And there were conventual buildings. But again, what happened? They had just completed this, but in 1187, the church was spared at the fall of Jerusalem, but it was abandoned, so it suffered damage and considerable neglect. So that's it. That's basically the story of the structure. The claims of competing Christian denominations called the building to be partitioned off, which is a shame and it's a scandal, isn't it?
It is.
Right. There was a disastrous fire in 1808, which destroyed much of the fabric. Further severe damage was caused by restorations that followed the fire. Don't you like that? Damage causing restoration causing damage. The Crusader edicula. So the one that you see now, the little building over the church, was actually replaced in 1808, 1809. But then what happens? 1927, there's a severe earthquake. Mm-hmm. And the restoration doesn't really begin until 1962. So remember, they just kind of finished the restoration work when? Last year?
Yeah, in 2016 is actually when it was performed.
Right. So that gives you an idea of how much the church has gone through.
But when you go in there, unless you have some idea of what you're looking at, it can be very confusing. Mm-hmm. And you can lose your sense of direction in there. It's a phenomenal place, but it's certainly, you can tell that it's been construction built upon construction and some older than others. And it's there's just no other place like it, obviously. But it is kind of a mishmash when you're inside there.
Mm-hmm.
Identify which direction to go to.
Well, which is why I think it's always good to have a guide in that kind of situation, at least the first time.
Yes.
Or even the second time. I think it's important also to see, I'm trying to figure out, okay, I've got looking online. Okay, so here's a little tour, like you said. Of all the Christian holy places, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is probably the most difficult for pilgrims to come to term with.
It is.
Right? So you come in and like, okay, let's just kind of do it from memory, okay? Remember, you walk in through the doors.
Well, you go into this courtyard, this large courtyard before entering, and these beautiful ancient old doors that you go through, and then it can be very dark once you enter in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's natural light.
And remember, there's two doors, but one of them is blocked.
Right.
You only come in through the left-hand doorway. Why? Because the right one was blocked by Muslim conquerors in the 12th century. Again.
Yes.
So instead of following the tourists into the often gloomy interior, turn a hard right and ascend a steep curving flight of stairs. I did that
and
with my family.
And you go up to Calvary.
Exactly. You are now ascending the hill to Calvary, both words meaning place of the skull. And the stairs open to a floor that it's level with the top of the rocky outcrop on which Christ was crucified. It's about 4.5 meters above the ground, which again is kind of cool. And there's like two or three little chapels in there, right? There's the Chapel of the Franks, there's the 10th Station of the Cross, and then there's that incredible statue of Our Lady, that bust of Our Lady with
but
the seven.
That first room where we had Mass, and there's that beautiful scene of Christ on the cross, that's where they nailed Jesus to the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And then you step to your left, and that's where the cross was erected, and mm-hmm. that's where you can kneel down under an altar and put your hand in there, and you're touching the rock.
Mm-hmm.
Which the cross was in. I mean,
that's right.
It's a very moving place, and there's all sorts of icons and candles and ancient things there, and it's just overwhelming. And I think you'll attest to this that many people, we've been there twice, and the pilgrims that go there are so overcome by being in that very place.
We mm-hmm.
can't be affected by what transpired and that the sacrifice that was made there for us.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a very holy, holy site.
And yet, even there, I think at the apex of our historical faith, you have division. The ownership of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is shared between the Greek Orthodox Catholics and Armenian Orthodox. So the Greeks own the central worship space. The Armenians own the underground chapel of St. Helena. And the Catholics own the Franciscan chapel of the Apparition and the deep underground chapel of the Finding of the Cross. Together with that, you have three minor Orthodox communities, the Coptic, the Syriacs, and the Ethiopians.
But the Ethiopians, don't they have the roof?
They have the steps going up to the roof, and then the Ethiopian monks live in a kind of African village on the roof called Deir es Sultan, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah.
The rights of possession and use are spelled out by a decree called the status quo. So who divided up the church like that? The Turks in 1757. And this same status quo, this same decree, gives two Muslim families the sole right to hold the key that opens and closes the church.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tradition that goes back to 1246, which is pretty cool. We were also told, remember, each religious community guards its rights jealously. The often mm-hmm. uneasy relationship laid down by the status quo is typified by a wooden ladder resting on a cornice above the main entrance and leaning against the window edge. Remember that? That ladder? The ladder has been there so long that nobody knows how it got there. Various suggestions have been offered. It was left behind by a careless window cleaner. It had been used to supply food to the Armenian monks, locked in the church by the Turks. Maybe it had served to let the Armenians use the cornice as a balcony to get fresh air. But who knows? Nobody knows.
But the nobody's ladder, moving it.
That's right. The ladder appears in an engraving of the church, which is dating back to 1728. And it was mentioned in the 1757 edict that became the basis for the status quo. So This is pretty cool. In 1997, the ladder suddenly disappeared for some weeks after a Protestant prankster hid it behind the altar.
I did not know that happened.
When it was discovered and returned, a steel grate was installed over the lower parts of both the windows above the entrance. And in 2009, the ladder mysteriously appeared against the left window for a day. Isn't that funny? You find all these things. But anyway.
They had to get all those groups to agree when they went in and did that repair work in 2016, because
Everybody
was claiming their own territory there, because you would have to go through someone's territory to get to a certain place. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's very strange how they all do not get along.
That's right. So our time is running away from us. Let's pick up this discussion about the Church of the Holy Sepulchre when we see you next time. Thank you for joining us.
Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
I learned how many people we could help and how good you feel after you've helped others.
I know Lent is about giving, so I want to give.
These kids are talking about CRS Rice Bowl, a Lenten program known by generations of Catholic families. Children love it because they experience different cultures and gain a lasting impression of the people they are helping. You can bring CRS Rice Bowl into your home and experience the joy of seeing your children or grandchildren find new meaning in Lent. Visit crsricebowl.org to get started.
Rice Bowl inspired me to pray more and to pray for those who are less fortunate.
The Cincinnati Catholic Men's Conference is back. Tickets are on sale now for Saturday, April 28th at the Taft Theater at cincinnatimensconference.com or call 513-214-1534. The speaker conference roster is being hailed as one of the best lineups in the country. In rare appearances, come see Father Mitch Pacwa from EWTN, the man motivator Father Larry Richards, former Moeller High School and University of Notre Dame head football coach Jerry Faust, and the big celebrity keynote, Baz Rutten, UFC world champion, MMA world champ, and movie star. The conference theme is What It Means to Be a True Christian Man in Today's Society. Don't miss the incredible day of motivation, spiritual benefit, and fellowship with men from all walks of life. Get tickets now at cincinnatimensconference.com or call 513-214-1534. That's cincinnatimensconference.com or 513-214-1534. Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.